Welcome to a special edition of the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018. I'm John Podhoritz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Saurabh Amari, our senior writer. Hi, Saurabh.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman is not here today. We are convening to discuss the life and career and writings of Philip Roth, dead yesterday at the age of 85. His death brings to a close, as Abe was saying earlier, the period of the first and the great flowering of American Jewish writing in the second half of the 20th century. He was known to have loathed the joke that he, Saul Bellow, and Bernard Malamud comprised the Hart, Schaffner, and Marx of American Jewish writing. But his loathing, nonetheless, was ill-taken and unexpectedly humorless, since, in fact, that's exactly who they were, and their emergence, not that they all emerged at the same time. Bellow began writing in the middle of the Second World War, Malamud at the beginning of the 1950s, and Roth at the tail end of the 1950s, all separated in age by about 20 years. But their concerns, which were the life and times and existences of American Jews and the existential struggles thereof, coincided with a period of great ferment in the American Jewish community, the sense of acceptance and indeed of, I would say, cultural, that they represented a cultural vanguard in the United States after the Second World War, that they knew things and had things to say about America that were fresh and unexpected and funny and perceptive, and were embraced by the mainstream. Each one of these writers, Bellow, Roth, and Malamud, had published enormous bestsellers at various times in their lives, and were feted and celebrated well outside the realm of the world in which they from which they had emerged, which is the world of Commentary Magazine and Partisan Review, these small publications published out of New York by Jewish writers and editors, largely Jewish writers and editors, of a highbrow nature, who stood apart from the United States in some ways and felt disconnected from the United States in many ways, and yet found themselves embraced wholly and thoroughly by the larger culture. And
they were also, if you take those three, despite the biographical obvious similarities, they were wildly different stylists.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Malamud was a folklorist, was a kind of present-day folklorist of his time, using a tone of more akin to an old world fairy tale,
right,
than an America that, you know, we all inhabit, or that people of his age inhabited. Bellow, of course, very much combining very high and very low in his work. Funny, run-on sentences, incredibly erudite, and very much, you know, gripped with the question of how do I live as a man in the world as it is. And then Roth, who was kind of their younger brother, let's say, put all of it together. Roth was a short story writer first, as was Malamud, and Malamud's greatest work being his short fiction. And of course, Roth made his name writing short fiction, some of it for Commentary. Two of his earliest stories that are in Goodbye Columbus were published in Commentary, Eli the Fanatic, and I can't remember the name of the other one, which was oddly published as a piece of nonfiction in Commentary, but he published as a piece of fiction in Goodbye Columbus. And so There he was, this young upstart 27-year-old writer publishing Goodbye Columbus, an incredibly mature piece of writing, I think, and sort of took the world by storm. And he became a major American writer and a problematic figure in American Jewry from that moment onward.
How so, the problematic?
So this is where I think we have something different to talk about from a lot of people who are going to talk about Roth today. When Philip Roth published Portnoy's Complaint, his breakout book, in 1969, I think, 67, 69, I can't remember which year, this was a book that represented the unshackling of all restraint in the writing about American Jews by an American Jew. This is a book about a monstrous Jewish mother, a constipated Jewish father, a sexually confused Jewish boy obsessed with shiksas, largely because of the deformations introduced into his psyche by his mother. It was a deliberately cartoonish, deliberately satirical portrait of an extreme case of Jewish self-consciousness. That is the Portnoy's Complaint, which is in the form of a monologue, basically on a shrink's couch. So the book is a stand-up comedy routine. It's like a two-hour monologue by Alex Portnoy describing his life to his shrink, the last sentence, two sentences of which are described as the punchline.
Right.
So the punchline is, we may now perhaps to begin, yes? Meaning that this is going to go on forever. Right. He's just going to sit on the couch telling the story of his woes, his masturbatory excesses, and his devastatingly destructive relationships with non-Jewish women. The telling moment being when he finally proposes to his Gentile girlfriend, and out of nowhere he says, "Well, you're going to convert, right?" And he doesn't even know why he's saying it. And then she says, "Why would I do that?" And that's the end. He has to break up with her, even though he's just proposed to her, because despite everything, he needs her to convert. So not to turn this into a monologue, but in the end, the story of Philip Roth is he published this book. It was an enormous worldwide triumph. And Jews in America, not just Jews in America, Gershom Scholem, who was, you know, possibly the leading Jewish academic and intellectual alive at the time, Gershom Scholem said this book has done more damage to the Jewish people than the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. In commentary a couple of years later, Irving Howe wrote an essay about Roth in which he basically said that Portnoy's Complaint was a tired collection of hostile cliches, and that the worst thing you could do, anyone could do, would be to read it twice. And Marie Serkin, who was one of the leading American Jews of the time, wrote a letter to commentary in which she basically said this was a work that would warm the hearts of Nazis, just as... What's interesting about this, in my perspective, is, and maybe Abe, you can jump in here, Roth then proceeded, after a couple of novels in the 70s that were failures, I would say, Our Gang, a satire of, a very vulgar and bad satire of Nixon, a book called The Great American Novel, which was his effort to write Malamud's version of another version of The Natural by Malamud, and a very bizarre book called The Breast. He started to engage with the question of his own, the response to Portnoy's Complaint in a series of novels.
Right, because I was just trying to remember his excuse me, his fictional Portnoy was, first of all, I'm forgetting Roth's alter ego.
Nathan Zuckerman.
Nathan Zuckerman's.
Well, he had
Portnoy.
There was David Kepesh.
Right.
And Nathan Zuckerman.
But Nathan Zuckerman's Portnoy was a book called Karnofsky or
Karnofsky,
something,
that's
right?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you know, as John talks about in this period, Roth completely mined his himself and his place in the culture for material. And yeah, he was absolutely comfortable sort of continuing to make a spectacle of his of the way he stood out now as a flashpoint in Jewish America.
Right, but I would also say that these books, we're talking about The Ghostwriter, The Anatomy Lessons, Zuckerman Unbound, The Counter Life,
and then some later ones.
Those five books, which came out kind of pretty much in sequence, I believe, from about 1979 to 1987, something like that. Every one of these books is an effort to deal with the fallout from Portnoy's complaint. That's a very weird thing if you think about it. And in The Ghostwriter, which is the first one, which is basically the account of a weekend that he spends at Bernard Malamud's house. So the story in The Ghostwriter is there's Malamud has an assistant named Amy. She's living upstairs in this farmhouse in the Berkshires. And he goes into this extended fantasia in which Amy, who has an indecipherable accent, is Anne Frank. That somehow Anne Frank was spirited out of the camps, brought to America under an assumed name, has now emerged at Bernard Malamud's house. And he is writing about how his father, among others, was horrified by Portnoy's complaint and has an unctuous judge from Newark write him a letter saying, "Are you comfortable with this? The fact that this book would please the heart of Joseph Goebbels?" And he realizes in his fantasia that if he married Anne Frank, who could criticize him any longer? You can criticize the husband of Anne Frank. You can call the husband of Anne Frank a self-hating Jew or an anti-Semite. So I put it to you that someone who was writing a book like this 10 years after Portnoy's complaint and then continues to write books. He wrote a book in The Anatomy Lesson, which is largely about his bad back. He basically attributes his bad back to the piece that Irving Howe wrote about him in Commentary. I'm not kidding. I mean, however it's fictionalized. The Counter Life is a book about what he would have been like had he ended up in living in Israel. He could not let this go.
Is that his only major engagement with Israel? Because I'm trying to think.
Yes. No, he wrote Operation Shylock
as well. Yeah.
So talk about Operation Shylock.
The two have blended in my mind now because I read them both so long ago. But the Counter Life is kind of an amazing book. I mean, Roth was also by far the most experimental of the three writers that we discussed.
I mean, we should say, since we're already into the criticism part, that Philip Roth was a major American writer. I believe him to have been the greatest American prose stylist of his time. No one wrote better sentences. No one wrote better paragraphs. No one had a greater facility or command of the sheer command of the English language, the beauty with which he was able to, you know, capture moments and it was unparalleled. And if you think over writers since the end of the Second World War, you know, post Faulkner, post Fitzgerald, I think you would have to say that he was the best American writer of his time. And while Bellow was grander and Malamud was more timeless, and Roth's books are all very troubling. It doesn't say that much about us as a civilization, maybe, that he was the greatest American writer of his time. But I don't know that you could find, and he wrote, in the end, 28 novels. Bellow, I think, wrote 9 or 10. Malamud wrote fewer.
Right.
Malamud's novels are largely wildly unsuccessful, creatively, except for The Assistant and The Fixer, I think.
But, you know, I just want to say one thing you could say about why he spent so much time dealing with the fallout from Portnoy and dealing with himself generally as a topic, or I don't know if you can say it's because of this, but this is a piece of the Roth puzzle, is he was a solitary man. He didn't have a family. He spent his time, at points in Manhattan, but also in this sort of farm in
No, he lived in Connecticut and in Manhattan. He lived in both places.
Yeah. But the Counterlife, to go back to the Counterlife, was this amazing metafiction novel where you read one. It's Zuckerman retelling, I think, the tale of his brother, Henry Zuckerman, who initially is faced with this very Rothian dilemma of he has a heart condition that he can either take a medication for that will render him impotent, or he can get operated on, which has a high risk of death. And essentially, successive chapters sort of play out alternate routes from that initial decision. There's a dead Henry, mm-hmm. Who I think his mistress then sort of talks about, maybe to his ghost, if I remember correctly. Then there's a healthy, virile Henry who gets the operation. There's one who takes the medication and remains impotent, and I don't recall which one ends up in Israel,
in Israel. He ends up on the West Bank. He ends up as a settler,
absolutely,
on the West Bank, and Roth in a I think a pretty remarkable moment of imaginative. I wouldn't just quite describe it as sympathy, but evokes the world, and it was written in the 1980s. The world of the ideological settler, mostly through the person of a character, again, based on somebody named Joseph Lovinger, who was the kind of theorist of the settlements, whom he portrays quite brilliantly.
But I also think in one of the counter lives, mm-hmm. He treats the settlement movement less sympathetically as well, right?
I mean, so it's a complicated book, and so to pay tribute to... again, so I think maybe we stop for a second and then talk about the book. I think that we all agree, I think, pretty much came out of nowhere. He was 65 years old. He published American Pastoral. There is no cognate to it in his literary history, though it is a Zuckerman book, because it sort of it is told by Zuckerman. Begins with Zuckerman going to his 45th high school reunion at his school in Weequahic, Newark, and running into a classmate named Jerry Lavov, who says to him, "Hey, you know, the terrible thing that happened to my brother."
Rhymes with the love.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Isn't that the line from that's what they chant?
That's right, yeah. And he says, "You know, remember my brother?" And Zuckerman, of course, remembers his brother, because his brother was the great hero of Weequahic. He was this
all-American.
Yeah, he was a blonde Jew living in Newark. Everybody in the neighborhood worked for the local
glove
manufacturer. And here was this kind of, you know, figure out of a book, football, you know, star of every sport, incredibly good looking, tall, broad shouldered. So he's Zuckerman's hero, and then he goes off, becomes a successful businessman, marries a former Miss New Jersey, obviously not a Jew.
Meredith something.
Wire? No, yeah. Mary is the daughter.
No, yeah, Meredith.
It's right. Meredith, yeah. But then they have a daughter, and they have this beautiful life and a beautiful house, and everything is wonderful. And that's actually a moment he runs into the Swede, as he's called, and has a sort of false moment of bonhomie at some point in his life. And then the onion is peeled. Sorab, you were
I was a big fan.
Yeah.
Just beginning with, I struck. Or what I remember most right now, because I read it 10 years ago or something, was the just beginning with the description of how his family's glove business, how it was different, the handcrafting and the way the seams, you wouldn't see the seams the way you would with other gloves, and I mean, it's just so beautiful. And then, but yeah, the onion begins to peel apart, and you have this profound emptiness at the heart of the Swede's life, where you know, his wife resents him, and then obviously this the daughter who's really at the heart of the story, who's she has this terrible stutter. She's not as beautiful as her mother, and it's this tension between mother and daughter that runs through the book, and gradually becomes a kind of insane leftist terrorist.
Right. Well, so the other thing we should say is that the peeling of the onion, which is the brilliant one of the brilliant aspects of the book, is the Swede ends up he's remarried. He has three little kids, I think. And it's all like, oh, everything's great, everything's wonderful. And then Jerry says to Zuckerman, oh, he was destroyed. His life was destroyed. All of this is false because of the daughter he cannot mention and the story he cannot tell. And the story is that his daughter, Mary, terrible stutter, their home life is very vapid, becomes a... bombs the local post office.
Yeah, kills one person, a bystander. She's a sort of weather. It's never mentioned as the Weather Underground, I think, but it's obviously a kind of SDS Weather Underground kind of.
And I also recall that she goes through a spell of Jainism.
Well, that's afterwards. So he finds her. She disappears, the daughter, and then he finds her 4 or 5 years later in a strung out condition in Newark, where she is now a Jain, meaning having gone, she had participated in more terrorist attacks, but was now so pacifistic that she wouldn't kill an insect.
Yeah.
Right? And so it then turns out also that his wife had used her lover to spirit the daughter away, keep the daughter away from the authorities, and as a result, she had gone off again and participated in more terrorist attacks. Anyway, the whole thing is that the onion is peeled. The world of, you know, of success and glamour and monetary in the course of the 1960s is revealed as hollow. And the book ends, the last 100 pages are set at a dinner party. They're just a dinner party. And as Abe, you said before the show, this is something that Zuckerman makes clear he is himself imagining. What happens just before the marriage dissolves and the Swede goes off and finds himself a new family?
Which occurs to me now, touching on the books that we've touched on, is kind of a Roth, a recurring Roth sort of trademark. I mean, even in The Ghost Rider, it's never stated at all clearly that this woman that he encounters is the grown-up Anne Frank. It's a kind of imagining. It's a what if,
you know? What? She clearly isn't Anne
right.
Frank.
She might as well be for Zuckerman in a way, you know. And Counterlife too is presented as these kind of imaginings. It's sort of the Zuckerman books really have a lot to do with how a writer, I think, how a fiction writer deals with the people in his life and sort of half makes up who they are to him in some sense.
Right. I would so. Sorry.
I was just going to say that I found the breakdown of the daughter and the Swede's failure to kind of connect with her really, I mean, it's unbelievably painful to read because the Swede is a type of character that I feel like I know. I mean, in one sense, he's very Jewish, but in the other sense, it's very sort of any sort of, you know, first generation or second generation Italian, Irish, what have you, who's kind of made it, and he sort of has some idea of the good life, and it's not a great life, and it's kind of vapid, but he still has an idea, and he cannot transmit it to her. And there's towards the end, as she's becoming more and more radicalized, the prose format stops, and it almost becomes a series of dialogues. And she just doesn't, you know, whatever he says, she says something more insane and radical.
Right.
And it's so powerful and painful.
So I would say that this book, so I'm just reading, the remarkable thing is that this, the point is that the Swede's vision of the good life, of the American good life, is not in Roth's own telling here, and we'll get to why that it's weird that he went there with this, is real. It is a good life. He's a good boss. They live well. They're decent people. Things aren't terrible. They make mistakes here and there. And what they can't do is prevent the outside forces of American life from coming down on them like a ton of bricks. There is no way for him to protect his daughter from the 60s. That is actually sort of the point of the book. So the last two paragraphs of American Pastoral read as follows, quote, "Yes, the breach had been pounded in their fortification, even out here in secure old Rimrock," that's the name of the town they live in, "and now that it was opened, it would not be closed again. They'll never recover. Everything is against them, everyone and everything that does not like their life, all the voices from without condemning and rejecting their life. And what is wrong with their life? What on earth is less reprehensible than the life of the Lvovs?" Now, Sorab, you have in front of you, so think about this. This is a book that ends with the idea that American bourgeois, haute bourgeois life is the least reprehensible form of life that you could imagine, and yet here it is being destroyed by American society. 34 years earlier, in the pages of Commentary magazine in March 1961, Roth published an essay called Writing American Fiction. That is one of the most sheerly anti-American, violently anti-American things ever written. And it's really startling to read. I commend it to your attention. And what's striking about it is all you need to do is substitute Trump, Bannon, you know, names like Trump and Bannon and Avenatti and all this for what he is writing about here.
Yeah, and you just, I mean, the point is that the American life is too wild, too infuriating, too crazy for the novelist to even begin to get a
handle
on.
But also loathsome. So why don't you read this passage?
So he says, "And the American writer in the middle of the 20th century has his hands full in trying to understand and then describe and then make credible much of the American reality. It stupefies, it sickens, it infuriates, and finally it is even a kind of embarrassment to one's own meager imagination. The actuality is continually undoing our talents, and the culture tosses up figures almost daily that are the envy of any novelist." This is where you want to substitute contemporary names. Who, for example, could have invented Charles Van Doren, Roy Cohn, and David Shine, Sherman Adams and Bernard Goldfein, Dwight David Eisenhower, and so on and so forth.
So think about this. So this list, of course, we have Roy Cohn very much in the news, even now, yeah. 25 years after his death because of, or 30 years after his death because of his relation to Donald Trump. So he so loathes American life that he puts in this list Dwight David Eisenhower, the man who won the Second World War and saved the world from the Nazis. This is the tone of this essay, which is America is so disgusting and abhorrent that no novelist can keep up with the ludicrousness, right?
And it begins with a four-page single anecdote paragraph. I mean, it's one.
Yeah, it's a fantastic anecdote, by the way. It's like a sort of, you know, can you believe what's going on in America today? I won't describe it to you, but if you go read it, you'll see what. So he uses this and then says, we can't create anything that is as wild as American reality, and it just strikes us as though it's a huge unreality. That was 1961. It's now 2018, and the notion that, you know, my God, what this is so crazy. Richard Nixon was almost president, he says in this piece. I mean, 35 million people almost made Richard Nixon president. So, of course, the interesting thing to think about in relation to this is, see, maybe that's the real America. The crazy America is the real America, the America that throws up these wild, yawpish stories about people going crazy and these con men and, you know, snake oil salesmen taking over American culture. That is America. Philip, the Jewish American writer's America is not America.
Right. In fact, Roth in that essay is kind of looking at America almost as from a sort of European academic standpoint. I mean, he doesn't actually seem, his critique itself is not terribly American.
Right. Well, I think he even says that somewhere. I mean, then he goes on and he sort of attacks every other writer in America for not being good enough. I mean, it's a very obnoxious. It was a huge sensation. People still read this essay. It's not a mark of a person of particularly good character, I would say.
Well, one of the things that struck me about it, so he talks about the different ways that writers are forced to deal with the inability to capture this vulgar America. And one is by sort of investing in a style that competes with the substance. Because you can't capture the substance, but if you come up with a boisterous, bouncy,
the word he uses.
Muscular style, that's something to sort of hold on to. Or you have heroes who are sort of forced to just simply go crazy because of the overwhelming vulgarity of it all. And then he also says, or there are some that just sort of turn inward, sort of deal with themselves. And I think that's very much where he went for a number of years.
Right.
After this, I think this is kind of his justification, almost partial justification, is, well, I can't. All everything going on around me is a little too vulgar for me. So let me tell you about myself.
So let me tell you about how deeply vulgar and screwed up I am in my own soul.
Right. And then in 2015, 2016, suddenly there was his name was in the press, although he hadn't written something for, what was his?
He stopped writing in 2012. He announced his retirement from writing.
So it had been 3 or 4 years. But then suddenly in 2016, you started seeing his name appear in the newspapers, in New York Review, and elsewhere, and all tied to The Plot Against America.
Right, so, we should talk about that. So The Plot Against America was a book he published, I think, in 2008, and it postulates that, another counter-life,
right.
In which Charles Lindbergh, the isolationist pilot, becomes the president of the United States in 1940 and keeps us out of World War II. Now, here's what's interesting about that book, which is about the family, his family, Herman Roth, his father, and he dealing with living in an America governed by isolationists and anti-Semites. He creates this alternate reality, and then he doesn't know what to do with it. So the book ends with Lindbergh flying off somewhere and his plane disappearing into the ocean, and America being reestablished on the present timeline, because he had this, or he was seized by this idea, which is fascinating, and he couldn't actually get it down. Everyone's interested in it because of the conceit, but the book itself is a total failure.
Also, once again, he was a little too early in his panic about things, because if his essay and commentary is about the vulgarity of Nixon, he had no idea what was coming down the pike.
Yeah.
And Plot Against America was in part a response to the Bush years.
Right.
You know, it was part of this, Bush is the dictator that was in the air in the left.
And I Married a Communist, which is the book that directly followed American Pastoral. I think it's in, although it might be The Human Stain.
Those three are held up
as
a trilogy.
Yeah, Human Stain, American Pastoral, I Married a Communist, and The Human Stain. One of the either I Married a Communist or The Human Stain begins with this long rant about the Clinton impeachment. Fascinating long rant, pages and pages about the horror of the world in which you would even attempt something like this, whereas you could see the writer of Writing American Fiction looking at Bill Clinton, the guy who brings a girl up to his hotel room and says, kiss it, or, tries to get, seduces an intern who saves the dress. All of that is totally in keeping with
this?
Yeah, it's totally in keeping with who could have imagined that this would be the thing. But Roth, like,
doesn't fit into his
Right, so then we can get to Roth. Well, it's interesting that we're sort of going this critical route, but the part of the thing about Roth is that in Writing American Fiction, he makes fun of, with I think some justification, the invocation by writers like Bellow and Herbert Gold and writers of the time in the notion that what they're seeking is love, and that the answer to our alienation is love, and he sort of makes fun of this. And he's right that when Bellow does this, both at the end of Seize the Day and Henderson the Rain King, there's something false. It seems willed and false. But the thing about Roth's own writing is that, with the total exception of American Pastoral, which is a book about a man choked with love for his daughter who is destroyed by his inability to save her from the wreck and ruin that the culture is visiting on her, he knows nothing about love. There is nothing in his books about love.
That's
kind of books about. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to get at before.
Yeah,
I would say the other exception that comes up time again is when he writes about his family. Actually, I think he Plot Against America. I remember he rendered his father as
I think that goes to the bad conscience, because the first portrait of his father is Portnoy's complaint. His father is sitting on a toilet the entire book trying to take a dump.
And let us not forget Patrimony, which is an actual memoir, which was reviewed brilliantly by Neil Cazadoy
in our magazine.
Yeah,
that's right.
In commentary. Is just a sort of ruthless portrait of one's father in his last days. It's a terrible transgression.
So, but I think that he was writing these books, The Professor of Desire, which deals with his father, Patrimony, The Plot Against it. There are a couple of others, and that he is making amends. These are books, as I say, he had a bad conscience about Portnoy. I can't see it any other way, and he realized that he had gone too far, or that he and that we don't know what devastation this might have wrought on his mother and father. I can't imagine that it was anything less than devastation, combined with, of course, a Jewish parent's excitement and delight at their son's success. But
that's in the Zuckerman books too, is sort of dealing with celebrity,
and
literary success.
Right.
Counts people chasing him down the street of Manhattan with a sandwich.
So I would just say that my view of Roth as a writer is that he eluded greatness, eluded him, though he had everything you would need for greatness, precisely because of these two qualities. One that Abe mentioned, which is that he did not really know much about ordinary life. He never had a job. He never had a marriage. He didn't have children. And since he was so personal a writer, for the most part, it was very his not understanding of the ordinary quotidian workings of life was very limited. And love was something that was clearly totally absent from his life. And with this startling exception of this imaginative triumph of a father's desperate love for his daughter in American Pastoral, that feeling is not evoked anywhere in his 28 novels.
Yeah, and
they're mostly about sex and about the deformations of sex.
Right. Well, I was just thinking of where you see that sort of not having any grasp of loving connections and sort of day to day realities, and it occurs as late as Sabbath's Theater, which is another particularly vulgar novel. I mean, it combines the vulgarity with the Jewishness the way the Portnoy did, but this is a man who's at Roth was at least in late middle age then, and what is he writing about? a profoundly perverted puppeteer.
Yeah.
That's what he knows of existence, you know.
Right, and you know, the late work, the last five or six novels, are books about men whose powers are failing in various ways, intellectually, health in terms of health, and mostly in terms of their ability to have sex. So, The Dying Animal, for example, which is a late novella, is really a book about impotence, and you know, Human Stain has a whole passage about this professor based on the writer Anatole Breuillard finding himself late in life in a romance with a young woman, taking Viagra in order to be able to perform with her. Now, I'm not in my 70s, and I just think that if you as a writer, you end up, you know, toward the close of your life, and what concerns you are the mechanics of your own failure, that this is where a life lived entirely in the interior starting to look pretty tragic. That, you know, that rather than thinking about what will live on after you, or, you know, having being able to sort of think about what's going on with your grandchildren or your children or your wife, or taking care of somebody else who is also sick or something like that. That these qualities are not, and so you have this, and he was a very serious student of human life through himself, and you have this unforgiving, relentless, the tyranny of decline, and it's very powerful, and it's very evocative, and it's very much a kind of, in my sense, a kind of vision of hell. These books are punishing to read. Exit Ghost and The Dying Animal, and they are because there's no transcendence. There's no possibility of transcendence. He's not a believer, so he doesn't believe in transcendence of the body. He doesn't have children or grandchildren, so he's not a believer in the transcendence of, what would you call that, patrimony?
Memory and generations.
Or posterity.
Posterity.
Yeah. All he has is the progressive failing of his own body, and then in 2012 he's like, I can't even write anymore. I've had it.
Right. And Every Man is another one also. Every Man deals exclusively with... I think the protagonist there doesn't even have a name. I think it's just, it might as well have been called The Dying Animal, but it was called Everyman. Yeah.
So who are the great novels standing of that kind of generation now?
Well, that generation, I was talking to my father earlier today, who knew Roth, published writing American fiction and commentary in 1961, did not have a good relationship with Roth, who never forgave him for publishing Irving Howe's Coruscating essay, among other things. But, you know, my father's 88, and he said, look at the last week. So Philip Roth died, Tom Wolfe died, Richard Pipes, a longtime contributor to commentary, died at 94.
Bernard Lewis,
whose most important single essay was published in commentary in 1976. The Return of Islam, died at the age of 101. It's been a terrible week for, you know, American letters and American knowledge and American history. And if you think about it, who's left? Herman Woke is 104, something like that.
He really is, yeah.
Remarkably enough, Gertrude Himmelfarb is still with us at 94. But it's, I don't know, in terms of creative writers, but that generation, the generation that was the enunciation of American letters in the 1950s and 60s, so Roth, Bellum, Malamud, Updike, John Cheever, Mailer.
Well, I was about to say people, yeah.
Mailer, James John, I mean, people who don't necessarily hit the sort of the top quadrant, you know,
right.
James Jones or... try to think. John Barth, John Gardner. I mean, they're all gone. So who is succeeding them is, I don't know, Jonathan Franzen.
Ugh.
Jonathan Lethem, Michael Chabon, who else?
Of that older, you know, I'm a great partisan of John isn't, Abe is. Of Cormac McCarthy,
but Cormac McCarthy
is a so sui generis a figure,
right.
I mean, so Cormac McCarthy followed a path, you know, sort of the Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor path. I don't know any writer who really fits that description.
He was living in a trailer park, you know, whatever, and then I'm exaggerating somewhat,
right.
But out of the blue.
Yeah. And then there's another, you know, there's also, I know this is not a very popular opinion in conservative circles, but I enjoyed Don DeLillo's fiction a great deal. He came out of a sort of different thing. There's almost a line sort of that came out of Mailer separately, I would say, sort of Gaddis, DeLillo, Pynchon to some degree, I guess. DeLillo and Pynchon are still alive.
They're
you know, of that generation. I mean,
yeah,
they're in their 80s.
You know, and then there are, I guess, there's, you know, Tony. Then there are others like Toni Morrison, whom I don't think much of, but obviously that's much a minority opinion.
But I think the 20th century American Jews was a very specific sort of phenomenon in literature.
Yeah,
and that this is, you know.
Yeah,
this was the end of it.
Well, Bruce J. Friedman is still alive,
right.
And if you want to read hilarious Jewish fiction,
wonderful,
go find the stories of Bruce J. Friedman.
Stern,
yeah. Right? But Mother's Kisses, both of which are also flecked with problematic imaginings of Jews. But his short stories we published a short story by Bruce, two short stories by Bruce in this past decade, actually. But there is. Yeah, this sense, and this is the other thing about the Roth essay that we talked about that is kind of dispiriting. These were writers, this was an America that was awash in the idea of possibility and understanding that it had become the leader of Western, the leading, despite atavistic ideas that France was more serious and Britain was more, and, you know, we were so vulgar and thin and all this, but that America had become the leader of Western civilization and that there were these writers, if they hadn't existed, they would have had to have been invented because the country needed, just as, you know, Leonard Bernstein and Van Cliburn and people like that became major cultural figures in the world of classical music, and, you know, American acting took, you know, Brando and the method became sort of like took over from stately British acting at the, you know, at the Old Vic, and American movie making dominated and all of that. So too, American literature came to seem like the, you know, the going, the cutting edge of the cultural future. And for various reasons, the Jewish writers were at the forefront of that. But it was a moment in time. I don't think anybody feels this. We now feel this way in default. America is the world leader by default because nobody else is the world leader. But we have a president who doesn't want America to be the leader of the world. And we have a leftist culture that thinks that American culture is diseased and horrible and misogynistic and white privileged and that somebody else should take over.
I'm only thinking about this now, and I may be off on this and it may be worth sort of talking about, but it strikes me that Bellow was more sort of celebratory about the idea of America than Roth. No?
I mean, totally.
And even tickled by the vulgarity. To a certain extent, scolding about the chaos.
Yeah,
but you know, got a kick of the sort of a kick out of the lower elements, the street life as he saw it. And whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, one of Bellow's later works, and it's very negligible, is a novella called The Bella Rosa Connection, which is a book about the astoundingly vulgar Broadway impresario Billy Rose and how basically Billy Rose ends up playing a leading role in saving Jews and bringing them to Palestine. Sort of an imagine, it's kind of a fanciful imagining. But this was a total grasp of this. Roth had now the other thing to be said about Roth, I think, aside from his own writing, is that he was an important figure and a noble figure in the preservation and salvation and publicization of Eastern European literature before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union. That writers who were living in conditions of extreme discomfort in Hungary, in Romania, in Czechoslovakia. They were all supported by him, publicized by him. He published anthologies dedicated to their work, you know, George Conrad and Milan Kundera. And I mean, there are at least a dozen others whose names are not Joseph Skvorensky. I mean, there are names that are I can't draw
with Jerzy Kaczynski as well. I think.
No, I don't think so. No,
didn't?
And Jerzy was a fantasist and a fabulist. So that he had already come to America and made his own way. These are actually people who were still there, and they're okay. Writing in their own languages, and he got them translated and.
I had no idea he did that.
Oh yeah,
good on him.
Yeah, it was his one literary, you know, mission and important to note. So, but as I say, I mean, part of what we're dealing with here is the ways in which Roth was unable to transcend his own. Worst way you would put it is solipsism to really become a great writer. And on the other hand, as a, you know, as a life, as a writing life, few people in our time, you know, came anywhere close to producing the corpus of work over the period of time that he, I mean, remember, he first thing that he published, which I think was in commentary, was 1957. He stopped writing in 2012. That's a 60 some odd years of publication, 28 novels, four collections of essays and shorts, four collections of essays. I mean, it's a an extraordinary achievement.
Look, and the truth is, you know, on the one hand, there's this huge sort of offense of vanity on his part. That's sort of, well, how dare he assume that we always want to read about him and his inner life and his. But in fact, we did, because so much of it was beautiful and should be read, actually.
And to give him credit for integrity, he wrote what he had to write. He did not seek to publish into trends of the moment, right, sorts of things people wanted. He was a writer working out his own internal a corpus without reference to what the wider world wanted or expected of him. And, you know, that's a real, true, deep integrity that, you know, is not true of a lot of people. Like, if he were out today, he would probably write a, you know, a book, a Harry Potter-like book for tweens at some point, just to see if he could, you know, make some cash.
Or even in terms of topics. I mean, I think of Updike, a writer who I like quite a bit, but he, you know, he would sort of say, in this moment, here's the swinging novel. Here's the here's a terrorist novel.
Here's the anti-feminist novel. Exactly. Right. Yeah, he would sort of engage with one way in which he was like Updike in the later books, particularly in the trilogy, was just as you Saurabh talked about the gloves and the portrait of the glove manufacturer, which was like an act of deep study. Like, he went and sort of did kind of reportage, and in The Human Stain, there's a portrait of a Vietnam veterans group that is carrying around, that there is a touring version of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that goes from place to place, and a character in the book is involved in that, that he sort of went and kind of reported on American phenomena. That's very much like Updike in his best work in the Rabbit novels, each of the Rabbit novels. You know, one of the Rabbit novels is about running a car dealership. One of the other Rabbit novels is about the last days of a Rabbit as a linotypist working at a printing shop, the last days of hot type. And the descriptions of this are among the best things in American contemporary American literature, just as. And it shows what Roth could have been like, right, had he pulled himself out of his own navel more. Also, a beautiful portrait of a second-rate Catskills hotel in The Professor of Desire, sort of second rank, where David Kepesh's father goes for the summer, and that sort of thing. So, anyway, we will be back tomorrow with an actual political, you know, evanescent political podcast that will be probably out of date 5 seconds after we finish it, with Noah Rothman. But for this commemorative broadcast for Abe Greenwald and Saurabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.